This is Audible.
Audible presents this Brilliance Audio production of
K-Pax by Gene Brewer. Copyright 1995 by Gene Brewer and performance copyright 1995 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved. When we successfully treat a patient, we experience a burst of joy because we have helped a suffering person who is happy to have known us. But we also feel a secret joy because we have come to know him, and in knowing him, we know more of ourselves. Silvano Arietti. Prologue. In April 1990, I received a call from Dr. William Siegel at the Long Island Psychiatric Hospital. Bill is an old friend of mine and a distinguished colleague. On this particular occasion, the call was a professional one. Bill was treating a patient who had been at the hospital for several months. The patient, a white male in his early 30s, had been picked up by the New York City police after being found bending over a mugging victim in the Port Authority bus terminal in Midtown Manhattan. According to their report, his answers to routine questions were daffy. And after they booked him, he was taken to Bellevue Hospital for evaluation. Although he was somewhat emaciated, medical examination revealed no organic abnormality, nor was there evidence of formal thought disorder, aphasia, or auditory hallucination. And he presented a near-normal affect. However, he did harbor a rather bizarre delusion. He believed he came from another planet. After a few days' observation, he was transferred to Long Island, where he remained for the next 4 months. Bill was unable to do much for him. Although he remained alert and cooperative throughout the various courses of treatment, the patient was completely unresponsive to the most powerful antipsychotic drugs. At the end of it all, he remained firmly convinced that he was a visitor from K-Pax. What was worse, he was able to enlist many of his fellow patients to this fantasy. Even some of the staff were beginning to listen to him. Knowing that the phenomenology of delusion has long been an interest of mine, Bill asked me to take a crack at him. It couldn't have come at a worse time. As acting director of the Manhattan Psychiatric Institute, I was already swamped with more work than I could handle, and indeed had been phasing out patient interaction since January of that year. However, the case sounded both interesting and unusual, and I owed Bill a couple of favors. I asked him to send me a copy of the man's file. When it arrived, I was still bogged down by administrative duties, and a few more days went by before I found it lying on my desk under a pile of personnel and budget folders. With renewed dismay over the prospect of another patient, I quickly read through the chart. It summarized a puzzling history indeed. Although our spaceman was quite lucid and articulate, and demonstrated a strong awareness of time and place, he was unable to provide any reliable information as to his actual origin and background. In short, he was not only delusional, but a total amnesiac as well. I called Bill and asked him to make arrangements for the transfer of this nameless man, who called himself Prot, not capitalized, to my own institution. He arrived the first week in May, and a preliminary session with him was scheduled for the 9th, a Wednesday, at the time I usually set aside to prepare for my regular Principles of Psychiatry lecture at Columbia. We met at weekly intervals for several months thereafter. During that period, I developed an extraordinary fondness and regard for this patient. As the following narrative, I trust, will show, although the results of these sessions have been reported in the scientific literature, I am writing this personal account not only because I think it might be of interest to the general public, but also, to paraphrase Dr. Arietti, because of what he taught me about myself. Session 1. My first impression when he was brought into my examining room was that he was an athlete, a football player or wrestler. He was a little below average in height, stocky, dark, perhaps even swarthy. His hair was thick and coal black. He was wearing sky-blue corduroy pants, a denim shirt, and canvas shoes. I didn't see his eyes for the first few encounters. Despite the relatively soft lighting, he always wore dark glasses. I asked him to be seated. Without a word, he proceeded to the black vinyl chair and sat down. His demeanor was calm and his step agile and well-coordinated. He seemed relaxed. I dismissed the orderlies. I opened his folder and jotted the date on a clean yellow pad. He watched me quite intently. Evincing a hint of a smile, I asked him whether he was comfortable or needed anything. To my surprise, he requested an apple. His voice was soft but clear, with no detectable regional or foreign accent. I buzzed our head nurse, Betty McAllister, and asked her to see if there were any available in the hospital kitchens. While we waited, I reviewed his medical record. Temperature, pulse, blood pressure, EKG, and blood values were all within the normal range, according to our chief clinic physician, Dr. Chakraborty. No dental problems. Neurological exam, muscle strength, coordination, reflexes, tone, normal. Left-right discrimination, normal. No problem with visual acuity, hearing, sensing hot or cold, or a light touch, handling platonic solids, describing pictures, copying figures. No difficulty in solving complex problems and puzzles. The patient was quick-witted, observant, and logical. Except for his peculiar delusion and total amnesia, he was as healthy as a horse. Betty came in with two large apples. She glanced at me for approval and, when I nodded, offered them to the patient. He took them from the little tray. "Red Delicious," he said. "My favorite." After offering us a taste, which we declined, he took a large, noisy bite. I dismissed my assistant and watched as Prote devoured the fruit. I had never seen anyone enjoy anything more. He ate every bit of both apples, including the seeds. When he had finished, he said, "Thanks and thanks," and waited for me to begin, his hands on his knees like a little boy's. Although psychiatric interviews are not normally recorded, we do so routinely at MPI for research and teaching purposes. What follows is a transcript of that first session, interspersed with occasional observations on my part. As usual, during initial interviews, I planned simply to chat with the man, get to know him, gain his trust. "Will you tell me your name, please?"
"Yes."
Evidence for a sense of humor. "What is your name?"
"My name is Prote."
He pronounced it to rhyme with goat, not hot. "Is that your first name or your last?"
"That is all of my name. I am Prote."
"Do you know where you are, Mr. Prote?"
"Just Prote. Yes, of course. I am in the Manhattan Psychiatric Institute."
I discovered in due course that Prote tended to capitalize the names of planets, stars, etc., but not those of persons, institutions, even countries. For the sake of consistency and to better depict the character of my patient, I have adopted that convention throughout this report. "Good. Do you know who I am?"
"You look like a psychiatrist."
"That's right. I'm Dr. Brewer." "What day is it?"
"Ah, you're the acting director. Wednesday."
"Uh-huh. What year?"
1990.
"How many fingers am I holding up?"
"Three."
"Very good. Now, Prote, do you know why you are here?"
"Of course. You think I'm crazy."
"I prefer to use the term ill. Do you think you are ill?"
"A little homesick, perhaps."
"And where is home?"
"K-Pax."
"K-Pax?"
K-P-A-X. K-Pax.
"With a capital K?"
"It is all capitals."
"Oh. K-Pax. Is that an island?" He smiled at this, apparently realizing I already knew he believed himself to be from another world. But he said simply,
"K-Pax is a planet."
Then,
"But don't worry. I'm not going to leap out of your chest."
I smiled back. I wasn't worried. Where is K-Pax? He sighed, tolerantly it seemed, and shook his head. About 7,000 light-years from here, it's in what you would call the constellation Lyra. How did you get to Earth? That's somewhat difficult to explain. At this point, I noted on my pad the surprising observation that, even though we had only been together a few minutes, and despite all my years of experience, I was becoming a little annoyed by the patient's obvious condescension. I said, "Try me." "It's simply a matter of harnessing the energy of light. You may find this a little hard to believe, but it's done with mirrors." I couldn't help feeling he was putting me on, but it was a good joke, and I suppressed a chuckle. "You travel at the speed of light?" "Oh, no. We can travel many times that speed, various multiples of C. Otherwise, I'd have to be at least 7,000 years old, wouldn't I?" I forced myself to return his smile. "That is very interesting," I said. "But according to Einstein, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, or 186,000 miles per second, if I remember correctly." "You misunderstand Einstein. What he said was that nothing can accelerate to the speed of light because its mass would become infinite. Einstein said nothing about entities already traveling at the speed of light or faster." "But if your mass becomes infinite when you..." His feet plopped onto my desk. "In the first place, Dr. Brewer, may I call you Jean? If that were true, then photons themselves would have infinite mass, wouldn't they? And beyond that, at tachyon speeds..." "Tachyon?" "Entities traveling faster than the speed of light are called tachyons. You can look it up." "Thank you, I will." My reply sounds a bit peevish on rehearing the tape. "If I understand you correctly, then, you did not come to Earth in a spaceship. You sort of hitched a ride on a beam of light."
"You could call it that."
"How long did it take you to get to Earth from your planet?"
"No time at all. Tachyons, you see, travel faster than light and therefore backward in time. Time passes for the traveler, of course, and he becomes older than he was when he left."
"And how long have you been here on Earth?"
4 years and 9 months. Your years, that is."
"And that makes you how old now, in Earth terms, of course?"
357.
"You are 357 years old?"
"Yes."
"All right. Can you tell me a little more about yourself? Although I recognize the unreality of the man's story, it is standard psychiatric practice to draw out an amnesiacal patient in hopes of obtaining information about his true background."
"You mean before I came to Earth, or..."
"Let's start with this. How did you happen to be chosen to make the journey from your planet to ours?" Now the patient was actually grinning at me, though it seemed innocent enough, perhaps even ingenuous. I found myself poring through his file rather than gaze at his Cheshire Cat face and dark glasses. He said,
"Chosen? That's a peculiarly human concept."
I looked up to find him scratching his chin and searching the ceiling in an apparent attempt to locate the appropriate words to explain his lofty thoughts to someone as lowly as myself. What he came up with was,
"I wanted to come, and I'm here."
"Anyone who wants to come to Earth may do so."
"Anyone on K-Pax and a number of other planets, of course."
"Did anyone come with you?"
"No."
"Why did you want to come to Earth?"
"Pure curiosity. Earth is a particularly lively planet as seen and heard from space, and it is a Class 3B planet."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning early stage of evolution, future uncertain."
"I see. And this is your first trip to our planet?"
"Oh, no, I've been here many times."
"When was the first time?"
"In 1963, your calendar."
"And has anyone else from K-Pax visited us?"
"No, I am the first." I'm relieved to hear that. Why?
Let's just say it would cause a lot of people a certain amount of consternation.
Why?
If you don't mind, I'd rather we talk about you today. Would that be all right?
If you wish.
Good. Now, where else have you been? Around the universe, I mean.
I've been to 64 planets within our galaxy.
And on how many of those have you encountered life?
Why, on all of them. The ones that are barren don't interest me. Of course, there are those who are fascinated by rocks and weather patterns and...
64 planets with intelligent life?
All life is intelligent.
Well, how many have human beings such as ourselves?
Earth is the only one with the species Homo sapiens that I have visited so far. But we know there are a few others here and there.
With intelligent life?
No, with human life. The planets that support life number into the millions, possibly the billions. Of course, we have not visited them all. That is only a rough estimate.
We, meaning inhabitants of Capax?
Capaxians, Nolians, Florians.
Those are other races on your home planet?
No, they are inhabitants of other worlds.
Most illusionals are confused to the point that they stutter or stumble considerably when trying to answer complex questions in a consistent manner. This patient was not only knowledgeable about a variety of arcane topics, but also confident enough of his knowledge to weave a cogent story. I scribbled on my pad the speculation that he might have been a scientist, perhaps a physicist or astronomer, and made a further note to determine how far his knowledge extended into those fields. For now, I wanted to learn something about his early life.
Let's back up just a bit, if you don't mind. I'd like you to tell me something about Capax itself.
Certainly. Capax is somewhat bigger than your planet, about the size of Neptune. It is a beautiful world, as is the Earth, of course, with its color and variety. But Capax is also very lovely, especially when K-Mon and K-Ril are in conjunction.
What are K-Mon and K-Ril?
Those are our two suns, what you call Agape and Satori. One is much larger than yours, the other smaller. But both are farther from our planet than your sun is from yours. K-Mon is red and K-Ril blue. But owing to our larger and more complex orbital pattern, we have much longer periods of light and darkness than you do. And not so much variation. That is, most of the time on Capax, it's something like your twilight. One of the things a visitor to your world first notices is how bright it is here.
Is that why you are wearing dark glasses?
Yes.
I'd like to clarify something you said earlier.
Certainly.
I believe you stated that you have been on Earth for 4 years and some odd months.
9.
Yes, 9. What I'd like very much to know is, where were you living for those 4 or 5 years?
Everywhere.
Everywhere?
I've traveled all over your world.
I see. And where did you begin your travels?
In Zaire.
Why Zaire? That's in Africa, isn't it?
It happened to be pointed toward Capax at the time.
Ah. And how long were you there?
A couple of your weeks altogether. Long enough to become familiar with the land. Meet the beings there, all beautiful, especially the birds.
What languages do they speak in Zaire?
You mean the humans, I presume?
Yes.
Besides the 4 official languages and French, there are an amazing number of native dialects.
Can you say something in Zaireese? Any dialect will do.
Certainly. Mama Kotak Rampun.
What does that mean?
It means, your mother is a gorilla.
Thank you.
No problem.
And then where did you go after Zaire?
All over Africa. Then to Europe, Asia, Australia, Antarctica, and finally to the Americas.
And how many countries have you visited? All of them except Eastern Canada, Greenland, and Iceland. Those are my last stops.
All what, 100 of them?
More like 200 at present, but it seems to change by the minute.
And you speak all the languages?
Only enough to get by.
How did you travel? Weren't you stopped at various borders?
I told you, it's difficult to explain.
You mean you did it with mirrors?
Exactly.
How long does it take to go from country to country at the speed of light, or whatever multiples of it you use?
No time at all.
Does your father like to travel?
I detected a brief hesitation, but no strong reaction to the sudden mention of Prout's father. I imagine most Capaxians do.
Well, does he travel? What kind of work does he do?
He does no work.
What about your mother?
What about her?
Does she work?
Of course not.
They are both retired, then.
Retired from what?
From whatever they did for a living. How old are they?
Probably in their late 600s.
Obviously, they no longer work.
Neither of them has ever worked.
Apparently, the patient considered his parents to be ne'er-do-wells, and the way he phrased his answer led me to believe that he harbored a deep-seated resentment, or even hatred, not only of his father, not uncommon, but of his mother, relatively rare for a man, as well. He continued,
"No one works on K-Pax. That is a human concept."
No one does anything?
Of course not. But when you do something you want to do, it's not work, is it?
His grin widened.
You don't consider what you do to be work, do you?
I ignored this smug comment. We'll talk more about your parents later, all right?
Why not?
Fine. There are a couple of other things I'd like to clear up before we go on.
Anything you say.
Good. First, how do you account for the fact that, as a visitor from space, you look so much like an Earth person?
Why is the soap bubble round?
I don't know. Why?
For an educated person, you don't know much, do you, Jean? A soap bubble is round because that is the most energy-efficient configuration. Similarly, many beings around the universe look pretty much like we do.
I see. Okay, you mentioned earlier that Earth is a particularly lively place as seen and heard from space. What did you mean by that?
Your television and radio waves go out from Earth in all directions. The whole galaxy is watching and listening to everything you do.
But these waves travel only at the speed of light, don't they? They couldn't possibly have reached K-Pax as yet. He sighed again, more loudly this time.
But some of the energy goes into higher overtones, don't you know? It's this principle, in fact, that makes light travel possible. Have you studied physics?
I suddenly remembered my long-suffering high school physics teacher who had tried to drum this kind of information into my head. I also felt a need for a cigarette, though I hadn't smoked one in years. I'll take your word for that, Mr. Prout. One more thing. Why do you travel around the universe all by yourself?
Wouldn't you if you could?
Maybe, I don't know, but what I meant was, why do you do it alone?
Is that why you think I'm crazy?
Not at all. But doesn't it get kind of lonely, all those years? 4 years and 8 months, wasn't it? In space?
No, and I wasn't in space that long. I've been here for 4 years and 9 months.
How long were you in space?
I aged about 7 of your months, if that's what you mean.
You didn't feel a need to have someone to talk to for all that time?
No.
I jotted down, patient dislikes everyone? What did you do to keep yourself occupied?
He wagged his head.
You don't understand, Jean. Although I became 7 Earth months older during the trip, it really seemed like an instant to me. You see, time is warped at super light speeds. In other words...
Unforgivably, I was too annoyed to let him go on. And speaking of time, ours is up for today. Shall we continue the discussion next week?
As you wish.
Good. I'll call Mr. Kowalski and Mr. Jensen to escort you back to your ward.
I know the way.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd rather call them. Just routine hospital procedure. I'm sure you understand.
Perfectly.
Good. The orderlies arrived in a moment, and the patient left with them, nodding complacently to me as he went out. I was surprised to find that I was dripping with perspiration, and I remember getting up to check the thermostat after switching off the recorder. While the tape was rewinding, I copied my scribbled observations for his permanent file, making mention of my distaste for what seemed to me his arrogant manner, after which I filed the rough notes in a separate cabinet, already stuffed with similar records. Then I listened to part of the tape, adding a comment about the patient's lack of any trace of dialect or accent. Surprisingly, hearing his soft voice, which was rather pleasant, was not at all annoying to me. It had been his demeanor. Suddenly I realized that cocky, lopsided, derisive grin reminded me of my father. Dad was an overworked small-town doctor, the only time he ever relaxed, except for Saturday afternoons, when he lay on the sofa with his eyes closed, listening to the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts, was at dinner time, when he would have exactly 1 glass of wine and relate to my mother and me, in his offhand way, more than we wanted to know about the ringworms and infarctions of his day. Afterwards, he would head back to the hospital or make a few house calls. Unless I could think up a good excuse, he would take me with him, assuming erroneously that I enjoyed the noxious sounds and smells, the bleeding and vomiting as much as he did. It was that insensitivity and arrogance which I hated in my father that had annoyed me so much during my first encounter with this man who called himself Prot. I resolved, as always when something like this happens, to keep my personal life out of the examining room. On the train home that evening, I got to thinking, as I often do after beginning a difficult or unusual case, about the human mind and reality. My new patient, for example, and Russell, our resident Christ, and thousands like them, live in worlds of their own, realms just as real to them as yours or mine is to us. That seems difficult to understand, but is it really? Surely the reader of this account has become, at one time or another, thoroughly involved in a film, or absorbed in a novel, utterly lost in the experience. Dreams, even daydreams, often seem very real at the time, as do events recalled during hypnosis. On such occasions, who is to say what reality is? It is quite remarkable what some of those with severe mental disorders are able to do within the boundaries of their illusory worlds. The idiot savants are a case in point. Unable to function in our society, they withdraw into recesses of the mind which most of us can never enter. They are capable of feats with numbers, for example, or music, that others cannot begin to duplicate. We are still in the dark ages as far as understanding the human mind is concerned, how it learns, how it remembers, how it thinks. If Einstein's brain were transplanted into Wagner's skull, would this individual still be Einstein? Better, switch half of Einstein's brain with half of Wagner's. Which person would be Einstein and which Wagner? Or would each be someone in between? Similarly, in the case of multiple personality syndrome, which of the distinct identities is really the person in question? Or is he, she, a different person at different times? Are we all different people at different times? Could this explain our changing moods? When we see someone talking to himself, to whom is he speaking? Have you ever heard someone say, I haven't been myself lately, or you're not the man I married? And how do we account for the fundamentalist preacher and his clandestine sex life? Are we all Doctors Jekyll and Messrs. Hyde? I made a note to dwell for a while on Prout's imaginary life on his imaginary planet, hoping, of course, that this would reveal something about his background on Earth. His geographical origin, perhaps, his occupation, his name, so that we might be able to track down his family and friends and thus, in addition to allaying their fears about his health and whereabouts, get to the underlying cause for his bizarre confabulation. I was beginning to feel the little tingle I always get at the beginning of a challenging case when all the possibilities are still open. Who was this man? What sorts of alien thoughts filled his head? Would we be able to bring him down to Earth? Session 2. I have always tried to give my examining room as pleasant an atmosphere as possible, with cheerful pastel walls, a few sylvan watercolors, and soft, indirect lighting. There is no couch. My patient and I sit facing each other in comfortable chairs. There is a clock placed discreetly on the back wall where the patient cannot see it. Before my second interview with Prout, I went over Joyce Trexler's transcript of the first week's session with him. Mrs. Trexler has been here almost forever, and it is common knowledge that it is she who really runs the place. "Crazy as a loon," was her uninvited comment as she dropped the typed copy onto my desk. I had looked up tachyons, and found that they were, as he had indicated, entities traveling faster than light. They are purely theoretical, however, and there is no evidence suggesting their actual existence. I had also tried to check out the Zaire-ese, but couldn't find anyone who spoke any of its more than 200 dialects. However, although his story seemed perfectly consistent, it was no less problematic. In psychoanalysis, one tries to become the patient's peer, gain his confidence, build on what grasp he still has of reality, his residue of normal thoughts. But this man had no grasp of reality. His alleged travels around the world offered some sort of earthbound experience to pursue, but even that was suspect. He could have spent time in the library or watched travelogues, for example. I was still pondering how to gain some kind of toehold on Prout's psyche when he was escorted into my examining room. He was wearing the same blue corduroys, dark glasses, and familiar smile. But this time the latter did not annoy me so much. It had been my problem, not his. He requested a few bananas before we began, and offered one to me. I declined, and waited until he had devoured them, skins and all. "Your produce alone," he said, "has made the trip worthwhile." We chatted for a few minutes about fruit. He reminded me, for example, that their characteristic odors and flavors are due to the presence of specific chemical compounds known as esters. Then we reviewed briefly our previous interview. He maintained that he had arrived on Earth some 4 years and 9 months ago, traveled on a beam of light, etc. Now I learn that K. Pax was circled by 7 purple moons. "Your planet must be a very romantic place," I prodded. At this point he did a surprising thing, something that no other patient of mine has ever done in the nearly 30 years I've been practicing psychoanalysis. He pulled a pencil and a little red notebook from his shirt pocket and began taking notes of his own. Rather amused by this, I asked him what he was jotting down. He replied that he had thought of something to include in his report. I inquired as to the nature of this report. He said it was his custom to compile a description of the various places he visited and beings he encountered throughout the galaxy. It appeared that the patient was examining the doctor. It was my turn to smile. Not wanting to inhibit his activities in any way, I did not press him to show me what he had written, though I was more than a little curious. Instead, I asked him to tell me something about his boyhood on K-Pax, that is, Earth. He said, "The region I was born in, incidentally, we are born on K-Pax just like you, and the process is much the same, only, well, we'll get into that later, I suppose."
"Why don't we go into it now?"
He paused briefly as if taken aback, but quickly recovered. The little grin, however, was gone. "If you wish, our anatomy is much like yours, as you know from the physical examination. The physiology is also similar, but unlike on Earth, the reproduction process is quite unpleasant."
"What makes it unpleasant?"
"It is a very painful procedure."
"Ah," I thought, "a breakthrough.
Mr. Prout very possibly suffers some sort of sexual terror or dysfunction." I quickly pursued this lead.
"Is this pain associated with intercourse itself, with ejaculation, or merely with obtaining an erection?"
"It is associated with the entire process. Where these activities result in pleasurable sensations for beings such as yourself, for us the effect is quite the opposite. This applies both to the males and females of our species, and incidentally, to most other beings around the galaxy as well."
"Can you compare the sensation to anything else I might be able to understand or identify with? Is it like a toothache, or..."
"It's more like having your gonads caught in a vice, except that we feel it all over. You see, on K-Pax, pain is more general. And to make matters worse, it is associated with something like your nausea, accompanied by a very bad smell. The moment of climax is like being kicked in the stomach and falling into a pool of mot shit."
"Did you say mot shit? What is a mot?"
"An animal, something like your skunk, only far more potent."
"I see." Unforgivably, I began to laugh. This image, coupled with the dark glasses and suddenly serious demeanor, well, as they say, you had to be there. He grinned broadly then, apparently understanding how it must have sounded to me. I managed to regain my composure and carry on. "And you say it is the same for a woman?"
"Exactly the same. As you can imagine, women on K-Pax do not strive very hard to reach orgasm."
"If the experience is so terrible, how do you reproduce?"
"Like your porcupines, as carefully as possible. Needless to say, overpopulation is not a problem for us."
"What about something like surgical implantation?"
"You are distorting the importance of the phenomenon. You have to bear in mind that since the lifespan for our species is 1,000 of your years, there is little need to produce children."
"I see. All right. I'd like to get back to your own childhood. Can you tell me a little about your upbringing? What were your parents like?"
"That's a little difficult to explain. Life on K-Pax is quite different from that on Earth. In order for you to understand my background, I will have to tell you something about our evolution."
He paused at that point, as if wondering whether I would be interested in hearing what he had to say. I encouraged him to proceed.
"Well, I suppose the best place to start is at the beginning. Life on K-Pax is much older than life on Earth, which began about 2.5 billion years ago. Homo sapiens has existed on your planet for only a few tens of thousands of years, give or take a millennium or two. On K-Pax, life began nearly 9 billion of your years ago, when your planet was still a diffuse ball of gas. Our own species has been around for 5 billion of those years, considerably longer than your bacteria. Furthermore, evolution took a quite different course. You see, we have very little water on our planet compared to Earth. No oceans at all, no rivers, no lakes. So life began on land, or, more precisely, underground. Your species evolved from the fishes. Our forefathers were something like your worms." and yet you evolved into something very much like us. I thought I explained that in our previous discussion. You could check your notes. This is all very interesting, Prode. But what does paleontology have to do with your upbringing? Everything, just as it does on Earth. Why don't we proceed with your childhood, and we can come back to this relationship later if I have any questions about it. Would that be all right? He bent over the notebook again.
Certainly.
Very well. First, let's talk about some of the fundamental items, shall we? For example, how often do you see your parents? Are your grandparents still alive? Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Jean, you haven't been listening. Things are not the same on Capex as they are on Earth. We don't have families, as you know the term. The whole idea of a family would be a non sequitur on our planet, and on most others. Children are not raised by their biological parents, but by everyone. They circulate among us, learning from one, then another.
Would it be fair to say, then, that as a child you had no home to go to?
Exactly. Now you've got it.
In other words, you never knew your parents.
I had thousands of parents.
I made a note that Prote's denying his father and mother confirmed my earlier suspicion of a deep-seated hatred of one or both, possibly due to abuse, or perhaps he had been orphaned or neglected or even abandoned by them.
Would you say you had a happy childhood?
Very.
Can you think of any unpleasant experiences you had as a child?
Prote's eyes closed tightly, as they often did when he tried to concentrate or to recollect something.
Not really. Nothing unusual. I was knocked down by an app a couple of times and squirted by a mote once or twice. And I had something like your measles and mumps, little things like that.
An app?
Like a small elephant.
Where was this?
On Capex.
Yes, but where on Capex? Your own country?
We don't have countries on Capex.
Well, do elephants run around loose there?
Everything runs around loose there. We don't have zoos.
Are any of the animals dangerous?
Only if you get in their way.
Do you have a wife waiting for you back on Capex?
This was another toss from left field, again to determine the effect of a key word on the patient's state of mind. Except for a barely perceptible shift in his chair, he remained calm.
We don't have marriage on Capex. No husbands, no wives, no families. Get it? Or to put it more correctly, the entire population is one big family.
Do you have any biological children of your own?
No.
There are many reasons why a person decides not to have children. One of these has to do with abuse by or hatred of his parents.
Let's get back to your mother and father. Do you see them very often?
He sighed in apparent frustration.
No.
Do you like them?
Are you still beating your wife?
I don't understand.
Your questions are phrased from the point of view of an Earth person. On Capex, they would be nonsense.
Mr. Prote.
Just Prote.
Let's establish some sort of ground rules for these sessions, shall we? I'm sure you will forgive me if I phrase my questions from the point of view of an Earth person, since, in fact, that is what I am. I could not phrase them in Capexian terms even if I wanted to, because I am not familiar with your way of life. I am going to ask you to humor me, to bear with me in this. Please try to answer the questions in the best way you can, using Earth expressions, which you seem to be quite familiar with.
whenever possible. Would that be a fair request under the circumstances?
I am happy you have said that. Perhaps we can learn from each other.
If you are happy, I am happy too. Now, if you are ready, maybe you could tell me a little about your parents. For example, do you know who your mother and father are? Have you ever met them?
I have met my mother. I have not yet run across my father.
It's his father the patient hates.
Run across? K-Pax is a big place.
But surely,
if I have met him, no one has pointed out our biological relationship.
Are there many people on your planet who don't know who their fathers are? He grinned at this, quickly picking up on the double meaning.
Most do not. It is not an important thing.
But you know your mother.
Purely a coincidence. A mutual acquaintance happened to mention our biological connection.
That is difficult for an Earth person to understand. Perhaps you could explain why your biological connections are not important to you.
Why should they be?
Because, for now, let me ask the questions and you give the answers, all right?
Sometimes a question is the best answer.
I suppose you don't know how many brothers and sisters you have.
On K-Pax, we are all siblings.
I meant biological siblings.
I would be surprised if there were any. Almost no one has more than one child, for reasons I have already explained.
Isn't there peer pressure or government incentives to make sure your species doesn't die out?
There is no government on K-Pax.
What do you mean? It's an anarchy?
That's as good a word as any.
But who builds the roads, the hospitals? Who runs the schools?
Really, Gene, it's not that difficult to understand. On K-Pax, one does what needs to be done.
What if no one notices that something needs to be done? What if someone knows something needs to be done but refuses to do it? What if a person decides to do nothing?
That doesn't happen on K-Pax.
Never?
What would be the point?
Well, to express dissatisfaction over the wages being paid, for one thing.
We don't have wages on K-Pax, or money of any kind.
I jotted this down. No money. What do you barter with?
We don't barter. You really should learn to listen to your patients, Doctor. I told you before, if something needs to be done, you do it. If someone needs something you have, you give it to him. This avoids a multitude of problems and has worked pretty well on our planet for several billion years.
All right. How big is your planet?
About the size of your Neptune. You'll find this also on the transcript of last week's conversation.
Thank you. And what is the population?
There are about 15 million of my species, if that is what you mean. But there are many other beings besides ourselves.
What kind of beings?
A variety of creatures, some of whom resemble the animals of Earth, some not.
Are these wild or domesticated animals?
We don't domesticate any of our beings.
You don't raise any animals for food?
No one raises another being for any purpose on K-Pax, and certainly not for food. We are not cannibals.
I detected a sudden and unexpected note of anger in this response. Why? Let me just fill in one or two blanks in your childhood. As I understand it, you were brought up by a number of surrogate parents. Is that right?
Not exactly.
Well, who took care of you? Tucked you into bed at night?
Utterly exasperated. No one tucks you into bed on K-Pax. When you are sleepy, you sleep. When you are hungry, you eat.
Who feeds you?
No one. Food is always around.
At what age did you begin school?
There are no schools on K-Pax.
I'm not surprised. But you are obviously an educated person.
I am not a person. I am a being. All Capaxians are educated. But education does not come from schools. Education stems from the desire to learn. With that, you don't need schools. Without it, all the schools in the universe are useless.
But how did you learn? Are there teachers?
On Capax, everyone is a teacher. If you have questions, you just ask whoever is around. And, of course, there are the libraries.
Libraries? Who runs the libraries?
Gene, Gene, Gene. No one does. Everyone does.
Are these libraries structures we Earth people would recognize?
Probably there are books there, but many other things as well, things you would not recognize or understand.
Where are these libraries? Does each city have one?
Yes, but our cities are more like what you would call villages. We have no vast metropolises such as the one in which we are presently located.
Does Capax have a capital?
No.
How do you get from one village to another? Are there trains, cars, aeroplanes?
A deep sigh was followed by some incoherent mumbling in a language I couldn't understand, later identified as Paxo. He made another entry in his notebook.
I have explained this before, Gino. We get from place to place on the energy of light. Why do you find this concept so hard to understand? Is it too simple for you?
We had been over this before, and with time running out, I did not intend to be sidetracked again. One final question. You have said that your childhood was a happy one. Did you have other children to play with?
Hardly any. There are very few children anywhere on Capax, as I have indicated. Besides that, there is no distinction between work and play on our planet. On Earth, children are encouraged to play all the time. This is because you believe they should remain innocent of their approaching adulthood for as long as possible, apparently because the latter is so distasteful. On Capax, children and adults are all part of the same thing. On our planet, life is fun and interesting. There is no need for mindless games, either for children or adults. No need for escape into soap operas, football, alcohol, or other drugs. Did I have a happy childhood on Capax? Of course, and a happy adulthood as well.
I didn't know whether to feel gladdened or saddened by this cheerful answer. On the one hand, the man seemed genuinely content with his imaginary lot. On the other, it was obvious he was denying not only his family, but his school experiences, his childhood itself, even his country, everything, every aspect of his entire life, which must have been quite abominable indeed. I felt a great deal of pity for this young man. I ended the interview with a question about his hometown, but this also led nowhere. Capaxians seemed to drift from place to place like nomads. I dismissed the patient, and he returned to his ward. I had been so astonished by his utter denial of everything human that I forgot to call the orderlies to go with him. After he had gone, I returned to my adjacent office and went through his entire file again. I had never experienced a case like this, one for which I couldn't seem to find any kind of handle. Only one other in 30 years was even close, and it also involved an amnesiac. A student of mine was eventually able to trace the man's roots through an analysis of his reawakened interest in sports, but it took a couple of years. I jotted down what I had on Prote so far. 1. P hates his parents. Had he been abused? 2. P hates his job, the government. Perhaps society as a whole. Had there been a legal problem resulting in a perceived injustice? 3.
Did something happen 4 to 5 years ago that underlay all these apparent hatreds?
Or, on top of everything else, the patient has a severe sex hang-up. As I looked over these notes, I remembered something that my colleague Klaus Villers had professed on more than one occasion. Extraordinary cases require extraordinary measures. I was thinking of the rare instances in which a delusional of exceptional intelligence has been convinced that his identity was false. The most famous example of this treatment is the one in which a well-known comedian graciously consented to confront a delusional look-alike, and a miraculous cure was quickly effected, but not before they both put on quite a show, evidently. If I could prove to Prout that he was, in fact, an ordinary human being, and not some alien from another planet, I decided to do a more thorough physical and mental workup on him. I was particularly interested in learning whether he was, in fact, abnormally sensitive to light as he claimed to be. I also wanted to have the results of an aptitude test, and to determine the extent of his general knowledge, particularly in the areas of physics and astronomy. The more we knew about his background, the easier it would be to find out who he really was. When I was a senior in high school, our career counselor advised me to take the one course in physics our school offered. I quickly learned that I had no aptitude for the subject, though the experience did serve to increase my respect for anyone who could master that esoteric material, among them my wife-to-be. We were next-door neighbors from the day she was born, Karen and we played together all the time. Every morning I would go outside and find her in the yard, smiling and ready for anything. One of the fondest memories I have is of our first day in school, of sitting behind her where I could smell her hair, of walking home with her and leaves burning. Of course, we weren't really sweethearts at that age, not until we were 12, the year my father died. It happened in the middle of the night. My mother came and got me up because she hoped, vainly as it turned out, that I might be able to do something. When I went into their bedroom, I found him lying on his back, naked, sweating, his pajamas on the floor beside the bed. He was still breathing, but his face was ashen. I had spent enough time in his office and on hospital rounds to suspect what had happened and to recognize the seriousness of the situation. If he had taught me something about closed chest massage, I might have been able to help him. But this was before CPR was generally known, and there was nothing I could do except watch him gasp his last breath and expire. Of course, I yelled at my mother to call an ambulance, but it was far too late by the time it got there. In the meantime, I studied his body with horrible fascination, his graying hands and feet, his knobby knees, his large, dark genitalia. My mother came running back just as I was covering him with a sheet. There was no need to tell her. She knew. Oh, she knew. Afterwards, I found myself in a state of profound shock and confusion. Not because I loved him, but because I didn't. Had almost wished him dead, in fact, so I wouldn't have to become a doctor like him. Ironically, because of the tremendous sense of guilt I felt, I vowed to go into medicine anyway. At the funeral, Karen, without anyone saying anything, sat beside me and held my hand. It was as though she understood perfectly what I was going through. I squeezed hers, too, hard. It was unbelievably soft and warm. I didn't feel any less guilty, but with her hand in mine, it seemed as though I might be able to get through life somehow. And I've been holding it ever since. On Friday of that week, we received a visitor from the State Board of Health. His job is to check our facilities periodically, see that the patients are clean and properly fed, that the plumbing works, etc. Although he had been here many times before, we gave him the usual grand tour: the kitchen, the dining and laundry and furnace rooms, the shop, the grounds, the recreation exercise room, the quiet room, the medical facilities, and finally, the wards. It was in the rec room that we found Prout sitting at a table with two of my other patients. I thought that a bit odd, inasmuch as one of them, whom I shall call Ernie, almost always keeps to himself, or talks quietly with Russell, our unofficial chaplain. The other, Howie, is usually too busy to talk to anyone.